Hello and welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm editor-in-chief of Science Progress, a project of the Center for American Progress. And our guest today is Dr. Fred Grinnell, who is by title professor of cell biology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. But he's a lot more than that, as we'll learn in this half hour. Fred has published a book just this year with Oxford University Press called Everyday Practice of Science, Where Intuition and Passion Meet Objectivity and Logic. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Very nice
to be here.
Great. Very nice of you to join us. We have a lot of listeners to these podcasts who are either themselves practitioners of science or getting ready to be, or policy wonks concerning science. This book is for them and for a lot of other people, too. It's a very rich book, and we're not going to be able to dig into all of it, of course, in the next few minutes. But I thought we might start by asking you to talk a little bit about yourself, because I think that will help people to understand what you're doing in the book. You are both a basic scientist who works on wound healing, as I recall.
Right.
You're also an ethics professor, a professor of science and humanities. Could you talk about how you were taken into those latter fields, starting out as a kind of classical lab scientist?
Well, I think I was always very interested in things other than just science.
Mm-hmm.
Research was my passion, but from the time that I was in college, or maybe even earlier, I was always puzzled by how people came to know what they thought they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became something that over time I had a chance to explore more systematically. And I just happened to be lucky enough that when I came to Dallas as an assistant professor in cell biology, there was a fellow named Richard Zehner, who was the chairman of philosophy at Southern Methodist University. And he took me on as sort of a student. So I studied with him for a number of years and learned about his interest. And his interest sort of overlapped between continental philosophy and bioethics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got increasingly drawn into those subjects and those interests and had the chance to pursue them. And then incidentally, as my research career progressed, occasionally things came up that had ethical boundaries that were challenged. And even in the first time that I was involved in a human research protocol, there were some significant ethical issues that arose.
Mm-hmm.
And so that got me involved in human research ethics.
Right.
And so there were just lots of things that emerged during the course of my scientific career that invited me to reflect on the meaning of what I was doing in science. And I ended up, it was a lot of fun, I ended up designing a website that has two entries in it. It says doing science, and then it says reflecting on what doing science means. And I like to describe my lifestyle as spending my mornings sort of working around the laboratory and my afternoons reflecting on the meaning of how I spent my morning.
Right.
And there's a certain degree of truth about that. So that's, and I've been lucky enough to be able to pursue that.
And you're one of a handful of people in my experience who are well-established, well-funded scientists who are not only interested in the clinical ethics and the applications of science in clinical trials, but also in ethics as it appears in basic research, in laboratory work, in bench science. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you've got a portion of your book that talks about research integrity, but it's there aren't a lot of people like you who are working seriously in that area who are also bench scientists.
So there's a kind of irony here. I began teaching a course in what's called philosophy of science to graduate students in our biomedical sciences, and this was in the late 1970s. And then over the period of the 80s, there were a number of cases, an increasing number of cases of scientific misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
Significantly, the National Institutes of Health passed a policy around I think 1988, that made it a requirement for all NIH trainees, graduate students, to take some kind of a course or exposure to issues relating to responsible conduct and professionalism and stuff like that. So our dean asked me if I would take my philosophy of science class and convert it into a responsible conduct of science exposure for the graduate students. So that sort of destroyed my philosophy class, but created something new and got me very much involved in thinking about, well, what do you say to students about responsible conduct, and how do you explain responsible conduct or discuss it in the context of what practice really entails?
Yeah.
Because there are so many situations in practice that are ambiguous and call for decisions to be made that have ethical ramifications.
And I think the point that you make very well in the book, The Everyday Practice of Science, is that you have to know something about the epistemology of science in order to be informed about the way that ethical issues can arise without necessarily appreciating how that happens.
Yeah, so let me just give you two examples.
Mm-hmm.
One happens to do with when you decide how to write a paper, what you're going to put in your research paper. And, mm-hmm. of course, you do many, many experiments, and many of them fail. And sometimes you learn from some of those experiments new ideas about what you're doing, but they're incomplete, and you have to do them over again in order to get them sort of conceptually right and pretty enough to be able to publish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the process of doing that, you may end up with 10 notebooks
yeah.
of data that gets selected, and I use that word purposefully,
yeah.
into 10 or 15 figures that become a paper. So there's a tremendous amount of data selection that has to occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable. So mm-hmm. the question is how to do that data selection in a way that's transparent and in a way that's reasonable. So if somebody else was looking at your notebook, they would say, oh, that's a reasonable thing to do. But a lot of times, scientists, like other people, disagree on what's important
yeah.
and what's not important. And so what turns out to be the golden data for one person might look like nonsense to somebody else, and then they would say, well, how could you possibly publish this? You know, you must have been selecting your data to fit your ideas.
Right.
And now all of a sudden you've switched from a question of intellectual honesty to a claim that you've behaved improperly.
Right.
Okay.
It's a very thin line.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's important for students to understand that, and in this particular context, it helps them understand why research notebooks mm-hmm. are so important, because the papers that we publish are reification
mm-hmm.
of what we actually do, both in terms of the data that we select and the order in which we present the work and the ideas that are presented. What we do is we make a nice story,
mm-hmm.
and that story doesn't really reflect in any sense how the story arose.
Yeah.
And that's one of the main things that I try to do in this book is make it clear how these stories in science arise.
Yeah, you weave these two stories together beautifully, I think, in the first half of the book, which is devoted to science, as you say, practicing science, discovery, and then credibility. The point that there's a kind of formal account of science, and then there's the informal account. And there's a kind of creative relationship between them. They inform each other. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
But neither is a complete picture of the way science actually is done. And that's so very important, I think, for people who are contemplating a career in science to understand. My first psychology professor in college, I think the only thing that I remember from Psych 1, on the very first day of class, I wrote on the board, scientists don't do science the way scientists say they do science. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. As a matter of fact, it's necessary in the real world, but you have to understand the way the systems work in order to appreciate that that's not a matter of lack of honesty. It's a process of, as you say, discovery that you have to go through. And Related to that is the epigram of the book, which was quite, I think, intriguing, taken from your seventh grade science teacher. Science is serious play.
Leon Perkins.
Right. And so, first of all, thanks, you know, so much to Mr. Perkins for his career. The notion of serious play, I think, in many ways gets at the essence of what you're talking about in this relationship, this sort of this byplay. And there's another sense of play, right? It's a word with several meanings. And when we say that there's too much play in the kite string, you know, there's too much give, or there's not enough give, there's not enough. The play indicates that there's got to be a certain generosity, a certain laxity in order to get the result you want. If you're too formalistic in the lab, you can't produce anything. If you're not paying attention enough to the formalities, then you know you could get accused of being sloppy. And in fact, you would be sloppy. So you talk a little bit about more about science as serious play.
Well, I have to say, Jonathan, that you've just given me an insight that I didn't have before. Because I never thought of that double entendre meaning of the word play. I thought about it as the seventh grader who learned that, of the idea that science was something that was fun and exciting and an adventure to do, and that it was an important thing, it was a serious thing,
right.
So you could combine those two.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. There is a sense in which knowledge has to be, in its development, playful in the idea of not being too rigid.
Right.
And in fact, I spend all this time, a tremendous amount of time in the book, talking about noticing and the importance of noticing for discovery. And I have never, ever until this moment thought about this idea of play in the line of
science,
needing to have enough freedom of expression in order to be able to see something new. And it really fits this idea. You know, I talk about this famous conversation between Meno and Socrates,
right.
Plato's book, Plato's dialogue.
The great Meno dialogue, says, the Meno. Yep.
Where Meno says to Socrates, "How will you look for it, Socrates, if you don't know at all what it is?" And Socrates says, "I know what you mean, Meno, because if you find what you're looking for, you haven't discovered anything." And if you don't know what you're looking for, how can you discover it?
Yeah.
And of course, Plato ends up concluding that discovery, in the sense that we mean discovery, is impossible.
Yep.
And so it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it's wrong in the sense that Plato treats discovery as an event.
Right.
If it were an event, he would be right. But discovery is a process.
Yeah.
And that process creates play.
Yep.
In the sense you meant.
Yep.
In between. And provides opportunities for noticing, and I try to, in the book, as you know, offer some examples of that, and how you can notice something. And actually, there's that diagram in the book where I challenge people to try to notice this famous humorous insert in this figure that was published by a Nobel laureate, and there for 10 years before anybody ever noticed this humorous insert in the figure. So,
and fortunately, Aristotle comes along and provides a more naturalistic account of the way we learn, but would not have been able to do that without the rather more rigid epistemology of Plato. So listeners can already see that there's a lot going on in this book, and that only has to do with the metaphysics and epistemology of science. You also, I think it's quite interesting, you sort of start with the epistemology and then you take the reader through a pretty, some would say, you know, mundane stuff about, but so important for scientists to understand about the way that science is funded and regulated. So can you say a little bit more about why it's important for scientists to know that? Why, a young person who's getting into thinking about it, contemplating a career in science, why would it be important for them to understand that? What do they need to know about the way the system works?
Well, I have a friend who's an insurance agent, and he was chairing a committee one time, and I was a part of his committee. And he comes to me after one of our meetings, and he says, "What's wrong with you, Grinnell? You're acting like an idiot." And I said, "Well, I'm writing my grant renewal. And my grant renewal determines whether or not, you know, what my salary is going to be, what my life is going to be like for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And so then he says to me, he says, wait a second, let me get this straight. He says, you write a grant, and if it gets funded, you know what your life's going to be like for the next 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. He says, let me tell you about what the real world is like. Okay? And then he told me about his life and that he doesn't know what's going on for the next 4 or 5 weeks necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, in a sense, he's very right. But there is a kind of lifestyle that's been created, not because science needed to be that way, or biomedical science, but it's the sort of the, what we call the soft money lifestyle, in which faculty members have become responsible for raising some or all of their own salaries as part of their research grants.
Yeah.
And that creates all sorts of conflict.
Yeah. Tenured or not, you're still dependent on that source.
That's right. Well, yeah. And, you know, in my case, my position doesn't depend on my grants, but my salary does.
Right.
But for a lot of other people, as I point out in the book, you know, getting a position sometimes depends on having a grant or keeping it or keeping your salary. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny lifestyle. And ironically, when the presidential committee that suggested that faculty salaries should be funded by the federal government put its suggestion into the form of a recommendation to the president back in around 1960 or so, they said specifically, but the money shouldn't be raised by the professors. They shouldn't be raising their own salaries.
Yeah, and yet...
But that's where we're
at.
That's
what happened. Yep.
So people have to be aware of that and understand that there's a certain degree of tension that's created in that system and a certain degree of uncertainty because from year to year, depending upon what Congress does, there may be more money or less money. We just had this tremendous input of funds because of the Obama stimulus package.
Yes.
But everybody's worried about, well, what's going to happen a couple of years from now when that money goes away and now all the have this extra, you know, projects underway. Does that mean that they're all going to be competing at the same time for money and then the success rates will go down? Well, my research grant just got refunded for 4 more years.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That made me kind of nervous, I have to tell you. The first time it went in, it didn't get funded, and I had to revise it and send it back. April 1st. So I hope that's not April Fool's Day. So it got funded April 1st, and it's going to take me beyond the end of the stimulus package sort of a crunch that's going to occur. And I have to tell you, from a practical point of view, I'm very happy about that for me, but it has nothing to do. There's no merit. It's not totally a meritocracy, this funding system. It also has to do with when you happen to have your grant going in and what else is going on. So there's a certain uncertainty in this process, and you have to be prepared for that.
And, of course, it's not only the faculty who are affected by this sort of chancy system. It's also the grad students, the fellows, the technicians in your lab,
everybody,
the assistants, everybody. It does seem to be perhaps too unpredictable a system for science in the 21st century, particularly in the life sciences, very much like the physical sciences now, requires so much capital and takes time to gear up a lab. By the time you've sort of kind of gotten on your feet, you're already looking to the next grant cycle.
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that have arose in our funding process and the way we've used science that may have worked in the past, but we have to begin sort of rethinking about. Let me just give you a sort of example relating to this, relating to grants in a sense. You know, we are very much dependent on what we call peer review, both for papers, for publications, and for grants. And what peer review basically says is that, you know, we're going to have other scientists evaluating the work that's proposed, either to decide whether it's worth funding in the case of grants or whether it's worth publishing in the case of work that's already been done. Or where it's worth publishing. So one of the things that happens in peer review is that the people who are the peer reviewers are the ones who often understand the work the best. But they're also the ones who have the best opportunity to potentially utilize or at least be influenced by this advanced knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't use it directly, even if it's just there in their mind. Yeah. So that, for instance, if I know about some work that's being done, and then I see something else somewhere else that might attract me, but I know it's wrong, because, or at least I believe it's wrong because of something else I heard, that influences my behavior. I can't avoid it. So peer review inherently gives an advantage
mm-hmm.
to peer reviewers
mm-hmm.
that people who are not peer reviewers don't have. Well, if you look at the National Academy of Sciences definition of conflict of interest, it has two definitions. One is financial, but the other is that anybody who gets a personal advantage is in conflict.
Yeah.
So inherently, the peer review system is conflicted.
Yeah.
So we're having this big discussion now, first, in the community about how to deal with conflict of interest, but the soft money funding system inherently conflicts that from a financial point of view, the situation of the investigator, and the peer review system inherently puts into conflict the peer reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
So the fundamental structure of the system is one that has built into it a significant degree of conflict of interest.
Right.
So, but maybe not all conflicts of interest are bad. And maybe we have to begin rethinking about what we mean by conflict of interest. And I think it's the same issue with funding. We have to think about ways of funding that allow the system to be stabilized, effectively trying to overcome some of the problems that are occurring now.
And having been a peer reviewer myself, I hope not conflicted, it strikes me that another aspect of the system that's, you know, very positive that people don't highlight is the fact that it's an educational process for the peer reviewers. I learned so much about what's going on in my field and related fields from reading all of these applications.
Absolutely.
But as you say, there is an inherent tension there. We're talking about Everyday Practice of Science, a new book published by Oxford University Press, authored by Dr. Fred Grinnell at UT Southwestern Medical School. I want to end by asking you to say a little bit about the last chapter on faith and science, because it seems to be a perennial issue, something that doesn't go away. It crops up perhaps every decade or a few decades as a big public concern. And you start, what I must say is it's a brief and very accessible account of the relationship between, historically, between faith and science, or if you prefer, organized religion and science, and the discussion culminates in taking us into the intelligent design controversy of recent years. You have, not only a very balanced and rich account, but also a point of view that is a little bit different from the ones that we mostly hear about this topic. Could you talk a little bit about how you arrived at the view that you express in the last chapter?
So there are two separate issues here. One is, of course, faith versus or science and religion, and the other is mm-hmm. the intelligent design issue.
Mm-hmm.
So just to be clear, where the intelligent design issue is concerned, from my perspective, as I understand intelligent design, it's just not science. It has nothing to do with science, and therefore, the major debate that seems to me to go on as to whether or not it should be taught in the classroom has a very clear-cut answer. It might be taught in religion class.
Mm-hmm.
It might be taught in values class or in philosophy or in history, but it has no place in science class. Mm-hmm. So leaving that aside and then coming back to this issue of faith versus religion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a metaphor that I use in the book about encountering a rock on the beach. And the metaphor goes like this. You encounter this rock, and then there are certain things that you could think about when you encounter this rock. One is you could ask yourself, well, how did it get here?
Mm-hmm.
What's it good for? How can I get more of them? And this is all about control, controlling the world and what things are good for. It's a very utilitarian way of understanding. You could also look at that rock and say, and it sounds a little strange, maybe, what's the significance of the fact that this rock and I are sharing the beach together
mm-hmm.
at this moment? What does it mean about my life? or about me. And that's a way of thinking about the world that doesn't have to do with control, but has to do with meaning.
Right.
And maybe even has to do with how to take care of the world. Mm-hmm. What's my responsibility?
Stewardship, perhaps.
To take care of it. Mm-hmm. And so what I think happens in most discourse about science and religion is that people either say, well, they're separate, they're talking about separate things, or they say, well, they're opposing. And the point that I try to develop in the last chapter is that while they're separate, they're not and can't be separated.
Mm-hmm.
So that each of us, each person, when they experience the world, are forced to both look at it from the sort of scientific and religious point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that religious point of view is that the world has no meaning, even if that's your point of view,
meaning question is unavoidable.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah.
So what I try to do is make this argument that this is the archetypic way that people are,
yeah,
that we approach the world from both these perspectives. And then I offer, as an analogy towards the end of the chapter, the model from quantum physics of complementarity. Mm-hmm. And the reason that that model appeals to me is that it says that, well, you can have two things that are complementary in such a strong sense that they're both right.
Mm-hmm.
And that because they are separate, however, you can't judge one against the other. So, of course, obviously, if religion makes some claim like, you know, the Earth is 6,000 years old, then from my point of view, that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that kind of claim you can judge. But when religion makes a claim like life has meaning,
mm-hmm,
that's a claim that science can't judge very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually interesting to me. I've noticed that there's increasingly a discussion about the word dignity.
Yes.
In the bioethics literature.
That's right.
And I've been spending a lot of time lately trying to think about, well, does dignity mean something totally different from a religious point of view and from a scientific point of view?
Hmm.
Is scientific dignity something about genetics,
mm-hmm,
and about the nature of humanness aside from its rationality and,
mm-hmm,
and self-consciousness and things like that, whereas you have this other religious perspective going on? So it's, I think, it's a very rich area for investigation, like many things are, in terms of thinking about from these two different perspectives.
It sounds like you're on the way to your next book. Which,
well, that's my new project.
I had a feeling. while you're pursuing the grant that you just received for the next few years, you'll be working in this area as well, as you have been for years. And we're looking forward to the next book and the next podcast about the next book.
Well, maybe 10 years from now.
No pressure.
It's a slow process, I'll tell you.
Well, it's also a process of serious play.
Right.
So we've been talking to Dr. Fred Grinnell, professor of cell biology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School, about his new book, Everyday Practice of Science, Where Intuition and Passion Meet Objectivity and Logic, published by Oxford University Press. And that's available through Amazon and through Oxford University Press's website. And you can read more about Dr. Grinnell as well on the web. Fred, thanks very much for being with us on this Science Progress podcast.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Take care. We'll talk to you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.